honest. The expectation is that the government is going to be able to either win by a couple of points or lose by a couple of points, or in the worst scenario, they are hoping to retain 30% of the chamber's deputies, so that would allow him to block the reversion of vetoes, for example, or they are going to allow any attempt at impeachment. 30% gives them sort of veto power in deputy chambers.
Well, we look forward to
they
seeing.
They might do
what,
better than.
We look forward to seeing what happens. That was Maria Esperanza Cazulo. Thank you so much for joining me. That is it for me this week. Aisha Azarik is here from 1 p.m. tomorrow. My producer was Lizzie Highfield, and a great job she did too. And Ryan Boyden was putting up with me and pressing the buttons. And on the Times at One next week, it's Joe Coben. Right now, Jane Garvey on Times Radio.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon. It is 2 o'clock. This is Jane Garvey on Times Radio until four. And in the next couple of hours, grooming gang survivors want Jess Phillips' resignation if they're to return to the public inquiry panel. The only British soldier prosecuted over the Bloody Sunday massacre has been found not guilty of murder. And why are young women more likely to vote green than reform? Let's start with the news at two. Here's Stuart Willey.
Jane, thank you. Good afternoon. Three men have been arrested on suspicion of assisting Russia's intelligence service. Counter-terrorism police in London say the men, all in their 40s, were arrested this morning and searches continue. They warn of an increasing number of proxies being recruited by foreign spy agencies. A former British paratrooper accused of murdering two people on Bloody Sunday has been found not guilty on all charges. The judge said the evidence fell short of the standard required. It was the first prosecution over the 1972 killing of 13 people taking part in a civil rights demonstration. Soldier F always denied shooting two unarmed protesters in Londonderry. Mickey McKinney is the brother of one of those killed. He spoke outside court in Belfast.
Soldier F had been discharged from the defendant's criminal dock, but it is 1 million miles away from being an honourable discharge. Soldier F created two young widows on Bloody Sunday. He orphaned 12 children, and he deprived dozens of siblings of a loving brother.
The Prime Minister says he has faith in his safeguarding minister, Jess Phillips, despite some victims of grooming gangs calling for her to resign. They felt she called them a liar when she said the inquiry would not be broadened. Jim Gamble, a former police officer and head of the Child Exploitation and Online Protection Centre, was one of the frontrunners to chair the inquiry, but withdrew over concerns that it should be a judge.
I was clear that the terms of reference will need to be set by law, but by whoever is appointed chair, and that if I was appointed chair, those terms of reference would be fundamentally informed by victims and survivors.
Russia's former president, Dmitry Medvedev, says Donald Trump's oil sanctions are an act of war. The US president has placed new sanctions on the two biggest Russian oil companies after the Kremlin rejected his proposal to freeze the war in Ukraine along the current front lines. Dr. Adi Emshirovich is an energy security specialist at Oxford. He told Times Radio the Kremlin relies on fossil fuel income.
So almost a third of the Russian budget is coming from oil. So it's absolutely massive. And I'm not surprised by the reaction of the Russians, Medvedev, saying that it's an act of war, because if implemented properly, this is very, very serious for the Russian economy.
England's water companies have recorded their worst environmental performance on record. Serious pollution cases are up 60%. The regulator Ofwat says it's down to years of underinvestment and poor maintenance. Thames Water performed the worst, while only Severn Trent earned the top rating in the Environment Agency's annual review. £10 million is being spent on improving security at mosques and Islamic community centres after a suspected arson attack in East Sussex. The Prime Minister has pledged the money after visiting the building in Peacehaven this morning, which was damaged last month. The government says the funding will go toward CCTV, alarm systems, secure fencing and security staff. And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB. Online
and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the programme. It's Jane Garvey here between now and 4 o'clock this afternoon. Fee has been doing battle very valiantly with one of those unpleasant, let's say, digestive issues that does the rounds at this time of year. But we're very confident she will be back at 2 o'clock on Monday afternoon. So until then, we're going to go to Rome for an eyewitness account of the King's historic trip to the Vatican. Jane Mulkerins, always with us on Thursday, she's going to alert us to just some of the nuggets inside the Times Mag this weekend. This week, the 70-year-old woman who hired an escort to celebrate her birthday, and 84-year-old Bernie Sanders, still pulling huge crowds all over America. Putin doesn't like him, but we do. We've got Bill Browder this afternoon on Trump sanctions on Russia. After a woman is fined for pouring a coffee down a drain, could you be done for your handling of a salmon? I'm going to be talking to a man called Nigel Cawthorne, author of The Strange Laws of Old England. Big, big news today. Planet Showbiz rocked by an unexpected joint resignation. Tess and Claudia are both leaving Strictly. And our big guest is the brilliant crime writer Peter James on his latest bestseller, The Hawk is Dead. In fact, Fee has been able to do that interview, and you can hear her in action with Peter James after 3:30 this afternoon. First then, four abuse survivors are calling for the safeguarding minister, Jess Phillips, to resign, accusing her of betrayal over comments about the government's grooming gangs inquiry. Phillips' departure, along with the resignation of the victim liaison officer, is part of a series of conditions under which the four survivors would rejoin the inquiry. Well, yesterday, Jim Gamble became the second of two candidates to step down from the running to chair the inquiry. Here he is talking to John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive.
Well, when you see, you know, in the House of Parliament, politicians taking the opportunity to attack one another, you know, on this. We are years out from an election. So why don't they take the pragmatic view of, look, let's get reform, let's get Lib Dems, let's get the Conservatives, and let's get, you know, the current administration into a room. And let's say, look, let's not be divisive. Let's not use victims as a political football. Let's agree a common theme. And it seems to me that the argument with some is, you know, that you've taken too long. Well, yes, it's taken too long, but nobody has covered themselves in glory in this.
Jim Gamble. Aubrey Allegretti is the Times' chief political correspondent. What about Jim Gamble's point that, frankly, this isn't doing anybody much good at all and nobody emerges with a great deal of credit, Aubrey?
Well, I think part of the problem in this situation is that there are differing views. We had a minister on the morning rounds today talking about how some survivors actually really want Jess Phillips to continue in the role of safeguarding minister because they back her to be able to sort of shepherd through this inquiry, make sure that the right person is appointed. But that's despite the fact that you do have four survivors who have publicly stepped down from their roles on the Home Office panel. It sounds like there might be a fifth that's decided to do so as well. So the government wants to appear to be listening and conciliatory, but ultimately it's standing full square behind Jess Phillips, and it's deciding not to take the approach of those that have called for her to stand down.
So what exactly convinced the four survivors that they just didn't want to do this anymore?
Well, they say that there was evidence that Jess Phillips had suggested the scope of the inquiry could be widened, and that they were worried that that could potentially be used to make it some sort of whitewash or cover-up, or that it wouldn't be so specific in focus. Because, of course, there have been plenty of inquiries into the broader issues of child sexual exploitation and abuse, but this one is specifically designed to be focused on grooming gangs. And the Home Secretary has said repeatedly it needs to explicitly examine the idea of the religion and ethnicity of perpetrators to discover whether or not there was any particularly sort of overrepresented people among that. And so these survivors were suggesting that they'd been told the scope could be widened. Jess Phillips denied that publicly. And then evidence appeared that suggested that in the consultation document for these victims, they had been asked, would you support this inquiry examining any other aspects or being any wider? And so then the government came under scrutiny about whether or not it had misled people by suggesting there had been never been any attempt to in the first place. Why widen the scope of this inquiry. Government insiders effectively say, look, we were just asking for survivors' permission to be able to keep this inquiry laser focused in the first place. Mm. But now we've got into a to and fro about process.
So is there a possibility that this is a genuine misunderstanding?
Yeah, I suppose a charitable person could put it that way. I mean, Jess Phillips herself had so strongly suggested to some of the survivors that there was no attempt to widen the scope, and then they produced this sort of evidence. So I suppose the way in which it emerged appeared as though certain ministers were trying to deny something had happened that the survivors said they had evidence of with their own eyes. And that's the sort of final straw for some of those people who've now decided to walk away from this. So it's hard to see what's going to happen next. But the Prime Minister, we understand, is going to speak to those people that have left the panels individually. Mm. I imagine there will be a sort of conciliatory tone there, a sort of request for them potentially to come back or continue working with the government to give this inquiry the credibility it needs, even if Jeff Phillips is going to stay at the helm in the Home Office.
Yes, I mean, to many people who don't know an enormous amount about this horrible, horrible sequence of events, Jess Phillips seems to be a very passionate advocate for particularly female victims of sexual abuse. It's hard for many people to imagine quite what she's done wrong. She always speaks so passionately about this issue, and she always seems to be incredibly forthright and plain speaking.
Certainly, and she was kind of seen as one of the rising stars of Labour's earlier intakes, because she was somebody who really championed women's rights and campaigned against violence against women and girls. She started this tradition of standing up in the Commons and reading out the name of every girl and woman that had been killed by a man over the course of the past year to highlight the issue of the femicide, as she was calling it. So she's certainly a very strong campaigner on this. But I think you do speak to some MPs and ministers and they get frustrated. They say she's good at the rhetoric, but she hasn't managed to turn it into action. She is responsible for the government having lost the confidence of these survivors. And, you know, I was speaking to one Labour MP recently who said, I haven't seen her deliver anything apart from loud noise. I don't know what she's done. So they're frustrated that, obviously, once again, this issue of the grooming gangs is unresolved. It's being used to score political points against the Labour Party by opposition parties. And MPs feel very uncomfortable about that.
You've got to wonder who on earth would want to chair this inquiry, because it's a heck of a task, this, isn't it? I mean, who would or could do it? It needs to be someone who can satisfy all parties in the mix. And that just seems to me to be just about impossible.
Certainly. Well, I mean, part of the reason that the two sort of front runners to lead this inquiry stepped down was concerns over their background. I think one was a sort of former police officer, one a former social worker. And these were the sorts of professions that were accused of being sort of institutionally corrupt or ignoring the plight of victims. And so, you know, people were suggesting it's going to be very hard for anyone to be able to, you know, please all parties. There have been a few names thrown around. So Alexis Jay, she was the chair that handled the child sexual abuse inquiry that started in 2015, took 7 years, it reported in 2022. She was, in fact, the fourth person picked to chair that inquiry. And so, you know, there is a suggestion that maybe this process could take a sort of similarly long time, because it's a process that's been gone through before, that it's very difficult to associate all parties. Another name in the frame is the new Victims Commissioner, Claire Wrexham, but it's going to be quite difficult to alight on somebody that everybody can agree on. Baroness Casey, who's known as the sort of Whitehall troubleshooter, keen on sort of standing up to institutional resistance, all these sorts of things, she's been brought in to help appoint a new chair and sort of shepherd the inquiry along. Downing Street this afternoon have had to forcibly deny that Jess Phillips has been sidelined, and that's what Louise Casey's sort of been brought in to do, effectively take over that bit of her job. But it's not clear whether or not there's anybody who is yet sort of willing to do the job and who would be accepted by the survivors and victims involved.
Right. And whilst the search goes on for someone to chair it, there's no sign at all that it's going to get up and running in the foreseeable future. Is there a timeline at all?
No, certainly not. I was speaking to Downing Street this afternoon and pressed them on whether or not there would definitely be a new chair in post by the end of the year. They they didn't give that assurance at all. Baroness Casey's got other roles as well. She's basically chairing a commission on social care, which is meant to examine sort of cross-party proposals for significantly reforming England's social care system. It's been a sort of maligned, huge policy area by multiple parties, and her time and responsibility has really been going into that. But now she's going to get dragged into the grooming gangs inquiry yet again. So there's a suggestion that because her time is kind of split between some of these roles, it's just going to take a long time. And the government, of course, says it's better for this to take longer in terms of setting up the inquiry than for it to be rushed and then, you know, ultimately somebody who's not quite suitable to be picked. But they've also resisted a judge-led inquiry on the basis that they said that that would take too long. Yeah. So they're sort of caught between a rock and a hard place.
Yes, thank you very much indeed. Appreciate you coming on this afternoon. Aubrey Allegretti, The Times chief political correspondent. And just over to you, Barry says, Jess Phillips, very little mention of her precarious position as an MP in her constituency vis-a-vis her non-support for the inquiry. Well, Barry, I think it's unfair to say that she doesn't support the inquiry. She does. She would certainly say she does. But I take your point about her tricky position as a constituency MP. From Linda, I think you should be asking what Jess Phillips has actually achieved. Please don't say simply she's raised awareness. That's not a concrete achievement. And what else here from Robert? It's so obvious, I think, the government's attempting to deflect attention from the ethnic and religious aspects of the majority of the grooming gangs and the fact that most of them were in predominantly Labour-supporting communities with high populations of Pakistani origins. That's Robert's view. You can get involved as well. 0333 003 2353. There's no doubt that this is a controversial subject, but it's without a shadow of a doubt we need to have the truth about what went on in those grooming gangs. And certainly we owe answers, don't we, to those lives blighted by the actions of some men. Now, to the most read stories on the Times website this afternoon, at number three, suspect in Cheryl Grimmer's 1970 beach abduction unmasked by MP. A 69-year-old man, given the pseudonym Mercury, has been linked to the three-year-old British girl's disappearance in Australia in 1970. He was named by Jeremy Buckingham in the Australian Parliament, using parliamentary privilege there. The second most read story is three arrested on suspicion of assisting Russian intelligence. The men, all in their 40s, have been arrested in London. We will have more on that in the second hour of the programme. The most read piece, though, is that showbiz news. Really is. It's blindsided so many people. Tess and Claudia are leaving Strictly Come Dancing. In a joint statement, the BBC host said they were always going to leave together and it feels like the right time. More on that later too. You can read all of these articles on thetimes.com. You will need your digital subscription. And if you don't have one, get one. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe. And we will take your suggestions for who might be any way capable of replacing Tess and Claudia on that show. Thanks to Debs, who did say that she thought that Fee and I could have a bash. We've already turned it down, Debs. I mean, I've just got to put it out there. No question. I think everyone's actually saying it'll be Alan Carr or Rylan, or possibly both. But more details later. 0333 003 2353. Now, for the first time, at least since the reign of Henry VIII, and more likely, let's be honest, ever, a King of England and a Pope have prayed together.
The grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, and the love of God, and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with us all evermore.
Amen.
Well, the voices of the Pope, Pope Leo, and the other voice there, that of Stephen Cottrell, who I think, before Sarah Mullally takes over as Archbishop of Canterbury, is in charge of the Church of England because he is the Archbishop of York. And now, that joint prayer came as part of a state visit by the King to the Vatican. We all know it's come at the tail end of an incredibly difficult week for the King and his family. Andrea Martinez is a correspondent in Rome. Andrea, tell us, how is all this being received in Rome?
Good afternoon. So it is a windy day here in Rome right now, and King Charles and Queen Camilla have been here, and of course it marks a historic moment, really the culmination of decades of ecumenical efforts, both on behalf of the Anglican Communion and of the Catholic Church. King Charles was supposed to meet the late Pope Francis back in April. They met, but couldn't for a state visit because of the Pope's health. And now this marks a true moment for both sides of union, the first time they're praying together in 500 years since the Reformation. So I would say that the reception here in Italy has been decidedly positive. It's seen as a step forward in terms of bridging the two churches. And of course, this in part overshadows some of the news that is going on right now regarding the scandal rocking the king's family and Prince Andrew.
Yeah. I know that the palace is telling us this is the first time since the Reformation that the Pope and the King have prayed together. But actually, I think people have now decided that unless some evidence emerges, this is the first time the Pope and the King of England have ever prayed together, because I don't think anyone's certain that a previous Pope ever met a reigning King of England.
Yes, of course. I think the most important thing to note really is the fact that given the very delicate and at times tense relationship between the Church of England and the Catholic Church, lest we forget how the split happened back in 1534 as a result of Pope Clement VII not wanting to grant an annulment to Henry VIII. So truly a royal matter at heart. It's incredibly symbolic that the two sovereigns would get together and pray and try to find things in common. And, you know, King Charles and Pope Leo have a lot of points in common in their approach to the faith, their faiths, to the church, their churches, and to religion in general, and also to the environment, many, many topics. So this is not just a religious moment, but also one of, you could argue, of diplomacy as well, from many points of view.
Yeah, I think many people in Britain and probably everywhere in the world will have their own view on what the King might have been praying for this afternoon alongside the Pope. What else is he doing? I think he's going to visit a seminary, I read.
So at the moment, he is currently in one of the four papal basilicas, which is called St. Paul's Outside the Walls, a basilica that has a long connection to the United Kingdom. And he is there in a newly assigned seat. One interesting thing to note is that the Pope has granted English monarchs a new seat, and they have both granted each other new titles. The Pope will be Papal Comforter to the Church of England, while King Charles will be the Royal Comforter. So he is there at the moment, and then he will visit, as you said, a seminary, while Queen Camilla will visit some nuns, if I believe.
Yes, it would be interesting, wouldn't it, if Sarah Mullally had taken over as Archbishop of Canterbury, because that would have meant it would have made quite a picture, the female Archbishop of Canterbury alongside the Pope when the Catholic Church still doesn't have women priests. It is interesting. It's all very formal. The women in black, the Queen Camilla in black. I saw Yvette Cooper, our foreign secretary, in a black outfit as well. What is all that about?
I mean, there's a lot of pageantry associated with traditions in the Vatican and the Catholic Church. It's still very ceremonial. Many of these date back hundreds of years. So I think this is just a display on the British side of wanting to, in a sense, to be part of the tradition within the Vatican, the Sistine Chapel, the prayers that the Pope has set forward. So really a bridging of the two traditions. And of course, the Anglican Church does have a lot in common with the Catholic Church, especially in the High Church and in the sort of in the ranks at which King Charles finds himself. So we see a lot of similarities in the symbolism, in the icons, and even in the gifts which the Pope, the Pontiff, and King Charles have exchanged.
Well, what were they?
So if memory serves, it was an icon of Edward the Confessor from the King's side, and from the Pope's side, it was a mosaic.
Okay, very nice indeed. Thank you very much indeed for your time. Andrea Martinez, our correspondent there in Rome. News just in that doctors in England are going to go on strike for 5 days in November. This is in the row over jobs and pay. That announcement just in from the British Medical Association. Now, next on Times Radio, after a woman was initially fined £150 for pouring what was left in her coffee cup down a drain, what are the other laws you can break without even realising? It's Jane Garvey on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Nobody asks to have a lifetime of memories slowly erased. Nobody asks to have a loved one not recognize them. Nobody asks to feel lonely and confused. But today, you could change this. By leaving a gift in your will to Alzheimer's Society, you'll help fund life-changing support, vital campaigning, and groundbreaking research to tackle Britain's biggest killer. Discover the impact your gift can make. Search Alzheimer's Society Wills.
Ever wondered what power is? Power is transforming the sun into your own energy source. Power is getting energy companies to pay you. Power is enjoying your morning coffee, knowing you created the energy to make it. Well, you and the colossal ball of fire in the sky. Because with solar panels from Hive, the sun works for you. Hive, know your power. May not cover all electricity usage, roof and weather dependent. Paid for surplus requires eligible SET tariff.
They're bubbly, they're fuzzy, and they're ruddy delicious.
At Oddbox, we rescue farm fresh fruit and veg that's too odd for supermarkets. Then we deliver direct to your door, so every box and every crunch makes a difference to growers and the planet. Use the code RADIO to get 50% off your first box at oddbox.co.uk and help fight food waste, one curvy cucumber at a time. Offer excludes delivery fees, conditions apply.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms, helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
25 past two. It's always glorious looking at the message board. And this afternoon, we've got some historical nuggets coming our way, courtesy of you. Debs is back, and Debs claims that Alfred met a pope, Leo IV, back in 853 with his father, who was king. He was a young man at the time. I'm really sorry you're not doing Strictly, says Debs. All right, thank you. Stuart says King Macbeth of Scotland went to Rome, so he may have prayed with the then pope. OK, Stuart, there are no images of that meeting, are there? So we're at a loss there, really. And Jill is focusing on who should present Strictly after Tess and Claudia have decided to bow out. And Jill has gone for Anton Dubek and Oti Mabuse. Yes, I'm big fans of both. Why ever not? Keep your ideas coming. 0333 003 2353. Now, a woman who is fined £150 for pouring the remnants of her coffee down a drain has got her money back after a South West London council made a U-turn on what might be one of the country's most peculiar offences. The fine was initially given under a law which does make it an offence to dispose of water in a way likely to pollute land or water. Now, if that surprises you, you might also not know that it's technically completely illegal to carry planks of wood on public pavements, walk a cow in daylight hours, and handle a salmon in suspicious circumstances. Nigel Cawthorne was our man. He's the author of The Strange Laws of Old England. Here he is on finding out just how close we all are to becoming accidental criminals.
I wrote a book called The Strange Laws of Old England. And it's about 20 years ago. And then there were 358 volumes of statutory law in the UK, occupying 22 shelves in the British Library. There's another 682 volumes of local and personal acts, which occupy another 50 shelves. And then there's another 30 shelves of statutory instruments. So how can you possibly know all this? And there was a guy called Sir Cecil Carr, who after World War II was put in charge. He was chairman of the Statutory Law Commission, who was supposed to kind of slim it all down to make sense of it. And he said that the collection of statutory law in the UK could be characterised as beyond the average citizen's pocket to purchase, beyond their bookshelves to occupy, and beyond their intellect to comprehend. Right. So what chance have we got?
Well, I mean, some of them are bizarre. Why is it an offence to handle a salmon?
Well, indeed. I mean, as you say, these things... do not make sense. Part of it is that we had these old laws with the Anglo-Saxons, and when William the Conqueror came over, he introduced the French law of the forest. And then when the Normans weren't terribly popular again, the judges tried to reconstruct the old law. That's why we have common law now. So on top of all these statutes, we have precedents in law. So if 500 years ago a judge made a certain judgment, that is now part of the law as well. Are you keeping up here with this?
Well, just about. Right. I mean, if in doubt, blame the French. I mean, that's not a bad policy. Well, yes. There is some logic to some of the laws. I think I understand why it's not legal to wear a suit of armour inside the Houses of Parliament, because clearly that would be a very effective disguise, wouldn't it?
Well, indeed, and as a commoner, you're not allowed to die in there either.
Well, how do they get around that?
Well, what they do is they carry you outside and then sign a death certificate once you're out of it. Because the House of Parliament are actually a royal palace, so only royal people can die there.
Let's talk about some of the other bizarre laws. Although, again, I can understand that you shouldn't really carry a plank of wood along the street, because I imagine before they changed the law on this that people could very easily, perhaps if they were old or frail or their sight wasn't too good, they could be knocked all over the place by somebody carrying a plank of wood. I mean, that makes sense to me.
Well, yes, indeed. But there are strange things like carrying a bale of hay on top of a taxi in case the horse gets hungry. And, of course, you're in London, you're not actually allowed to hail a taxi in the street. You're supposed to go to a point where they all congregate. But the wonderful thing, I think, is the Magna Carta, which embodies our freedoms. And it says, this is from the 13th century, it says, these will be the laws in England for all time. There are 37 clauses. Only three of them are still valid. All the rest have been repealed.
And so, which three remain?
The freedom of the Church of England, the freedom of the old laws, of the old freedoms of the City of London and the St. Paul's, and the freedom not to be deprived of your property without due court proceedings.
Okay, well, that seems entirely reasonable. What is your view of this council? I think it was in Richmond, wasn't it? Which
initially
did fine this lady for pouring her coffee down a drain. What is your view of that?
This is simply bizarre and, of course, absurd, because, I mean, I think they dropped it in the end. But if she'd gone to court, no reasonable court is actually going to uphold, are they? There'll be other coffee drinkers in the jury.
Yes, so exactly. I mean, these days, what are we without our coffee? Most of us walk around with coffee more or less 24 hours a day. Is there a law, Nigel, that you'd like to bring in yourself?
Yes, I think a ban on selfies. people everywhere go holding their phones and taking selfies, and they don't seem to realise that they're warming the planet with them. That they think that it's like an old photograph, and you just make a photograph, and then because it's an electronic thing and it goes on a server, that picture to remain has to have electric current running through it at all time. So even if you put the services they're beginning to do now under the sea, you're still warming the sea up. People don't actually take one picture. They always think they'll take four or five pictures of the same thing.
Hear, hear. That's Nigel Cawthorne, author of The Strange Laws of Old England. He would like to ban the selfie. Simon just wants to school us. Well, probably school me. You probably all knew this. But Simon says, non-Roman Catholic royal women have to wear black at the Vatican. If you're Roman Catholic royalty, you can wear white. And he says, I think rather harshly, it's not hard for you to do some research. Well, actually, Simon, in my defence, I've been relatively busy since I came to work this morning. But no, you've got a point. And on to the very important subject of who should now host Strictly. Anne suggests a man who I didn't know, but I've looked him up, Tom Reed Wilson. Absolutely gorgeous, says Anne. Well, he is the expert who features on the show Celebs Go Dating, apparently, and he's certainly got a fan in Anne. Right, President Trump has announced sanctions on two Russian oil companies, But what's that going to do, honestly, to help bring peace to Ukraine? We'll talk about that. And we'll also discuss why so many young men are increasingly likely to vote for reform. You're with Times Radio. It's just after 2:30. Here are the headlines from Stuart Willey.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Jane, thank you. Good afternoon. A former paratrooper known as Soldier F has been found not guilty of two murders and five attempted murders on Bloody Sunday in Londonderry. The judge at Belfast Crown Court ruled the evidence presented against the veteran fell well short of what was needed for a conviction. Mark Devonport is a long-time Northern Ireland correspondent.
There were always going to be problems with trying to get the evidence which would stand up in a criminal trial 53 years after the event, and that is exactly what has happened today.
Resident doctors in England are to go on strike for 5 days in mid-November. The British Medical Association says it's over pay restoration and employment prospects. The Deputy Prime Minister has acknowledged there have been setbacks in establishing the grooming gangs inquiry. David Lammy says there's often not just one voice among survivors, as some continue to call for Jess Phillips to be sacked as safeguarding minister. Three men in their 40s have been arrested on suspicion of assisting Russia's spy agencies. They were detained by counter-terror police this morning under the National Security Act. A Metropolitan Police officer has been sacked after he was filmed making racist comments. PC Philip Nielsen was based at London's Charing Cross station, the focus of a recent television documentary. And the King has prayed with the Pope in a historic moment at the Vatican's Sistine Chapel. It's the first time in nearly 500 years such a service has taken place. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we have been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking, exploring the world in comfort.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
Ever wondered what power is? Power is transforming the sun into your own energy source. Power is getting energy companies to pay you. Power is enjoying your morning coffee, knowing you created the energy to make it. Well, you and the colossal ball of fire in the sky. Because with solar panels from Hive, the sun works for you. Hive, know your power. May not cover all electricity usage, roof and weather dependent. Paid for surplus requires eligible SET tariff.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens. 8 new kitchen styles now available, with prices starting from under £3,000. Whether you choose dusky pink, hazy blue or one of the other new styles, you'll be delighted with your kitchen transformation. Find out more at wickes.co.uk.
Well, I think we've got another vote for Tom Reed Wilson as a host of Strictly. Kat says, Tom is lovely. That's all her message says. That's apparently all she needs to say. Mark in Redditch, I don't think he's being entirely serious. He says the Strictly presenters should be Gary Lineker and Emily Maitlis. Mm. Actually, I think the truth there is the BBC probably couldn't afford them. So that's a no-no. What about Darcy Bustle and somebody else, says Susie. OK, well, that's an eminently sensible suggestion. 0333 003 2353. The incredible Jane Mulcairns will be here before 3 o'clock. She's going to be telling us about some of the delights in the Times magazine over the course of the weekend. Really interesting article, actually, all about Bernie Sanders, who is in his 80s and is still packing them in. He is drawing huge crowds to his events in the States, and people love Bernie. In fact, by the tone of the article, even Donald Trump has a kind of just a tiny little bit of affection for Bernie Sanders. So we'll try and find out more from La Mulcairns before 3 o'clock. Just taking his seat, the man who never stops working on a show, it's John Pienaar with news of what awaits us between 4 o'clock and 7.
Hello, Jay. So
Obviously, it's a really, really busy day today. When do I ever come here and not say that? But it's busy.
Never in my time have you ever said it's a quiet afternoon.
No, I haven't. So we've just got the news in. The junior doctors, as they were, the resident doctors, are going to be striking. They've taken a decision to strike in the second week of November. So a new, or if you like, an old front reopens. And we're going to be into all of that. So obviously we're covering that. And we've got developments in the war in Ukraine on two fronts. Donald Trump with his, as he called them, tremendous sanctions hitting Russian oil. We'll be talking about that. How hard is that going to hit? Are there workarounds? Is it going to be as tremendous as maybe the president was suggesting? Could be tough. The European Union meeting now and talking about a big, big move, assuming it goes ahead, and it's assumed that it will, to hand Ukraine a check for maybe 140 billion euros using frozen Russian assets. So I'm going to be looking at that too. And I've literally just been talking to a Russian legislator from Putin's party, who was telling me why it's not going to hurt Russia. Maybe won't even happen. It's not going to do anything to deter Russia from waging war. And telling me about the, you know, the incompetence of the Western powers and the atrocities being committed by Ukraine. All of that coming up almost as fast as I was able to politely tell him I thought it was a lot of nonsense in polite language. But you can hear that conversation too.
Yeah, I'm sure you always are polite, even to the most, shall we say, how can we describe, what adjective would you apply to this gentleman?
Putin-esque.
Okay, that'll do.
Kremlin-like.
Kremlin-esque. It's almost 20 to 3, actually. We're about to talk to Bill Browder on the same subject. But your suggestions for Strictly presenters are getting better, actually. I like this from Don. How about Angela Rayner and Liz Truss? You know, weirdly, Don, I suspect they can probably both dance. Susanna says, I know you don't dance if you're the host, but in fact, that's actually, if I was going to carp about Tess and Claudia, they don't really dance. I'd like to see them dance before they stop doing the programme. Susanna says, Jacob, Rees-Mogg and Boris. Okay. Right. 0333 003 2353. Now, serious stuff. The US president has announced a package of sanctions against two Russian oil companies, demonstrating, we're told, his impatience over the war in Ukraine. Moscow responded that it was immune to the new sanctions, but Dmitry Medvedev, the former Russian president and prime minister, claimed that they were an act of war. Here is President Trump announcing the measures.
They're massive sanctions. It's sanctions on oil. The two biggest oil companies, among the biggest in the world, but they're Russian. They do a lot of oil. And hopefully it'll push. Hopefully he'll become reasonable, and hopefully Zelensky will be reasonable too. You know, it takes two to tango, as they say.
Bill Browder is CEO of Hermitage Capital Management and author of the book Red Notice, How I Became Putin's Number One Enemy. Bill Browder, here we are again. This week, Donald Trump is very angry with Vladimir Putin and he's imposed these sanctions. Do you think they'll do anything?
Well, I've always said that we shouldn't judge Donald Trump on his statements because they're all over the place. We should judge him on his actions. And these actions are significant. To go after the two biggest oil companies in Russia, Lukoil and Rosneft, and to basically say that they cannot do any type of business with the United States, and I think the same thing is true with the European Union, that is a punishing sanction. Now, the second question is, will it lead to the end of the war? And I don't believe that it will, for one very important reason, which is, while we've sanctioned these two companies, which are so big in terms of selling oil, they can continue to sell their oil to India, China, and Turkey. And since the beginning of the war, Russia has sold 8 refineries in these three countries, $400 billion worth of oil. And that has not changed, and that will not change because of these sanctions. These sanctions mean that Lukoil can't sell oil to America, and that they can't bank with American banks, but it doesn't have anything to do with China or India.
I thought India was going to cut imports of Russian oil, indeed, because they had sanctions imposed on them too.
Well, India is considering it. So there's an announcement this morning from Reliance Energy, which is a big Indian oil refinery, that they're considering it, and it may very well happen. But all the other oil refineries, I've not heard the same thing. And so what I would say is that if we really wanted to get Putin on his knees, to basically put him in an economically impossible position, we have to make sure that everybody who buys the Russian oil understands that it's unprofitable for them to do so. And the way we would do that would be to go to these 8 refineries and say, it's either us being the rest of the world, or Russia. If you want to do business with Russia, you can't sell to us, you can't buy from us, you can't insure with us, you can't bank with us. And if we said that to those eight refineries, we're just talking about eight businesses, they wouldn't do it. And then the Russian oil would have to sell into some black market at $10, $20 a barrel. And I bet you in 6 months' time, Putin would be at the negotiation table begging to end this war.
Okay, so why hasn't that been done?
Well, I think the main reason it hasn't been done is that it's a scary thing to do. If you take Russian oil off the market, oil prices could go up.
Yeah.
In fact, they went up today. They went up 5% today with these sankctions against Lukoil and Rosneft. And I think President Trump actually leaned on the Saudis recently to increase their oil production, which was one of the reasons why oil prices were down before they went back up. And so they haven't gone up in absolute terms because they were down a little bit. But that's the main reason, is that there is some uncertainty about what would happen to the oil price.
Donald Trump is all about, what well, he said he was, all about bringing the cost of living down, getting prices down in the States. If petrol prices go up in the US, then he's in even more trouble than he already is. He just won't want it, will he?
He definitely won't want it. And I think that's one of the main constraints on doing something. And it wasn't just Donald Trump's constraint. It was also President Biden's constraint. So you have people realistically saying, we don't want to create any more inflation, and this is potentially inflationary. But it's also the thing that would bring Putin to end the war, because on one hand, he's selling his oil to India. A lot of Western countries are buying the refined product from India, and so he's getting the money indirectly from us, and then we're paying the Ukrainians to fight back. Something's got to give in this whole circular arrangement.
It wasn't that long ago that we were told that Trump and Putin were going to meet in Budapest. Now they're not. Do you think they're at all likely to meet in the near future?
Well, I never understood what that meeting was going to be about, because there was no there's no concessions coming from Russia. Putin has been very consistent. The one thing he's been is absolutely clear with everybody in the world that he has only one outcome to this war, which is total victory. And he's not ready to compromise. He's been very clear about that in every discussion he's had. And he continues to be clear about that. And so if you're trying to negotiate a ceasefire or some type of agreement, each side has to make concessions. And if Putin is unwilling to make concessions, then there's no reason to have a meeting with him in Budapest or anywhere else for that matter.
I know that my colleague John Pienaar is going to discuss this in more detail after 4 o'clock this afternoon. But these frozen Russian assets, we've heard so much about them. European leaders are meeting today to endorse plans to use them. Why hasn't this been done before? And briefly, if you can, why is all that Russian money in, for example, a Belgium-based financial institution, this place Euroclear?
Well, so when the war started, one of the things which the Western allies did very effectively was, about a week after the war started, they said all Russian government's money that's being held offshore in our central banks is now frozen. And that amount is $300 billion. Now, interestingly, Russia was always afraid of the United States. So only $5 billion of that was in the U.S. But they weren't that afraid of Europe. And so they held all their bonds in a custody account at a place called Euroclear in Brussels. And they thought their money was safe because the Europeans would never, you know, say a word if they did this invasion, because the Europeans had never said a word in the past. And all of a sudden, now we're in a situation where the war has gone on for 3.5 years. It's costing us a lot of money to support Ukraine. Why should we pay for it? Why should the British taxpayer or the European taxpayer pay for military aid to Ukraine when Putin could be paying for it? And so I've been arguing for the confiscation of this money for 3.5 years. And your question is the right one. Why hasn't it happened until now? And I think the answer is that governments are timid. Everybody's afraid of Putin's empty threats. And so we're now in a situation where governments may be timid, but governments are also timid with their own taxpayers. And we're all talking about budgets and money. And I think we'd much rather take that money from Putin than have to spend it or have to tax our own citizens to pay for this war going forward.
Bill Browder, thank you very much for talking to us this afternoon. Really appreciate it. And there'll be more on that issue of the frozen Russian assets here on Times Radio with John between 4 o'clock and seven this afternoon. Now, Reform UK is more popular than Labour among Gen Z men. This is according to a new poll. It found that 31% of men between the ages of 16 and 25 would support reform at a general election if it were held tomorrow. Nicholas Stevenson is a researcher at the Onward think tank. Nicholas, how many people did you speak to?
So we spoke to 5,000 16 to 40-year-olds. This was a poll conducted in association with JL Partners and also with the Conrad and Now Foundation. And yes, it's a very big kind of youth poll. We spoke to 5,000 people. And as you said, we have the outcomes of the voting intention are that among young men, 16 to 25, reform are leading. They have 31% of the vote. And amongst young women, there's a very, very different story. There's a rather large kind of gender divide, and that's what my report, Ballot for Sex, is all about.
So young women are skewing what, green?
Yes. So what's interesting about this poll is that they are just behind Labour among women aged 16 to 25. Labour on 27%, Greener on 25%. But we did the fieldwork for this poll between the 26th of August and the 8th of September. And, of course, this is when the Green leadership election was still kind of going on. And after Zach Polanski was elected, Green vote share has gone up. So it's quite likely that if we did the poll again today, the Greens would be first among young women.
Right. I have to say, whether you agree with the policies or not, Zach Polanski is he's a good communicator. He's got a certain amount of a popular appeal, hasn't he? And actually, the Green Party has needed a Zach Polanski to get it just up and running.
Yes, yeah, I think, Zach Polanski clearly knows what he's doing when it comes to communications.
Yeah. What is it about reform that is appealing to these young men? Do you know?
So we did some polling on the top three priorities for young voters, and there was some big differences between young men and young women, particularly in that 16 to 25 age group. So while women were more likely to kind of pick Gaza in their top three issues, it is a top three concern for women aged 16 to 25. Men were more likely to pick crime and antisocial behaviour and levels of immigration. And in fact, among the 21 to 25 age group and among men, it is actually the number one issue with 41% is above prices, food and energy bills and housing affordability.
So what is immigration, did you say?
Yeah, levels of immigration, yes.
Right, OK. And for women, they are looking at the wider world. So is Gaza the most important issue for young women?
It is top three. So I would say the number one kind of issue is prices, food and energy bills amongst women aged 16 to 25. But Gaza, the conflict in Gaza is top three.
Interesting. Thank you very much indeed. That's Nicholas Stevenson, a researcher at the Onward think tank. You're with Times Radio and Jane Mulcairns is with me next. And normally I have to give a smut rating for a Jane Mulcairns. And yes, I will have to do it again. She's talking about what's in the Times magazine this weekend. And yes, there will be some smut for you. This is Jane Garvey on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Weekday mornings on Times Radio with Bupa Small Business Health Insurance. When it comes to must-listen mid-morning radio, we've got you covered. There's world-class journalism to broaden your mind, in-depth discussion that gets right to the heart of the issues, and entertaining conversation guaranteed to tickle your funny bone. Weekday mornings on Times Radio with Bupa Small Business Health Insurance, your trusted business partner for health and wellbeing support. Find out more at bupa.co.uk.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You never forget the dogs you've loved. They have the power to steal our hearts, to love us unconditionally, and be there for us when we need them most, without saying a word. You understand how a dog can change a life. A guide dog can transform the life of someone living with sight loss. Will you help change someone else's life with a gift in your will to guide dogs? Request our free will guide today. Search Guide Dogs Free Wills.
Guide Dogs.
You want work to be less hard work. You hear an ad for MHR, so you reach out. We connect your department systems, which leads to real-time data sharing that uncovers new insights, which empower your decision-makers and triple monthly sales, which leads to high fives and awkward hugs. You say a big thank you. We say you're welcome. MHR, the science behind HR, payroll and finance. The science behind a new world of work. Discover more at mhrglobal.com.
Here's to the moment, to the places that give you perspective and the people who change that perspective, the curiosity that leads you to the edge of the earth and the joy that meets you there. Silversea brings you closer to the rare, the remote and the remarkable on spacious yet intimate ships that show you what most miss. Here's to having every reason to celebrate, to finding more. Learn more at silversea.com.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Well, let's just get straight to it. Jane Mulcairns is here. The Times magazine will be with you on Saturday. Now, one of the highlights, and it is actually, in all seriousness, a very interesting feature about a woman who hired a male escort to mark her 70th birthday. Tell us about this, Jane.
Yes, Jane. So, serious faces all round, for at least for a minute or
well,
two.
Absolutely, yes.
Gail Rice has written this piece, and honestly, I think she's a stone-cold icon. So, she writes about having been on and off dating apps in her 50s and 60s, and then, I mean, it's brilliant. She says she's basically just tired of listening to men complain about their exes and yearn for their deceased wives, and list their medical complaints, or gloat about their retirement funds, or rattle on about their golf handicaps. I mean, it can happen at all ages, I think is what we're saying.
I think it can.
She'd seen the Emma Thompson film, Good Luck to You, Leo Grand, and in this, Emma Thompson has a male escort. And Gail just thought, why not? And she started Googling escorts, found one, paid him £800. And in short, it didn't go that well.
Although it's really worth reading.
Yeah.
It didn't go well, but...
But she said it just... He basically didn't do his job, and this is probably my favourite part of the whole piece, is that when she sort of got over the disappointment of it, she basically sent him a very courteous complaint and explained her dissatisfaction and got a refund from her escort. And then she got back on the horse and she found another escort and had a much better time this time round. And it is a brilliant read on lots of levels, and we're sort of making light of it, but it's a very thoughtful piece. She's a psychologist, and so it's really, really thoughtful and interesting. And she, basically her payoff is really beautiful. She says, as I approach the later part of my life, I don't fear dying. I fear not living fully in the precious days, months and years left to me. So when it seems easier just to float down the river, I'm going to pick up my oars and occasionally go into the rapids to say yes and be curious and stay engaged. She was saying that, you know, she's 70 and she's okay being single, but she feared the idea of never being sexual ever again, or not being sexual in the eyes of another. And I think she writes with such honesty and with bravery and with real self-awareness. It's okay. A brilliant read.
Can I just ask the question that I suspect will be WhatsApped?
Will we pay for one for a big birthday?
No, the question that I suspect will be coming our way on the WhatsApp message board momentarily, which is...
What if a man had written the same piece?
Well, yes, but can you answer it?
I suppose...
Answers on a postcard. Come on, Jane.
No, I suppose... is it any different to a man paying for sex work? I've got nothing against men paying for sex work. If it is... done with the full freedom of a woman's right to choose to work in that way, not someone who's been people trafficked, which is most of the sex work that women do.
Okay, so for the first person to complain about that, we've done it.
You can send them to jane.mulcairns@thetimes.co.uk.
Or me. It doesn't really matter.
Absolutely fine.
We can take it. So Bernie Sanders, really interesting...
that was an amazing segue.
Bernie Sanders. He's an old gent, isn't he? I hadn't realised he was quite so vintage, but... and he's not
an old white man in US politics. We haven't got enough of those,
actually,
have we?
No, who knew? He is even older than Donald Trump.
Donald Trump says 8, Bernie says 5. So this is a brilliant interview by Will Pavia with Bernie Sanders, who obviously has run for president twice, hasn't actually even been the Democratic candidate, but does have an outsized influence in US politics, particularly among young people right now. He's 84, he's written a new book called Fight Oligarchy. He's been arguing for years years that billionaires shouldn't exist and that billionaires are the oligarchs of America, basically, and that no one should have so great an accumulation of wealth and power because it's a huge danger to democracy. And he's now on this speaking tour of, he's selling out stadiums around America as, you know, we do know that the right is incredibly powerful in America right now, but there is also a socialist force that is growing in America. You know, look at Zoran Mandami, who's almost definitely going to be the mayor of New York next month.
Next month, is it? Okay.
Yeah, right. And you look at Amanda Ocasio-Cortez, who's a big supporter of Bernie, who will probably run for the presidential election in 2028. So it's not that there isn't another side to what we're seeing. Mm. I mean, all my friends went on the No Kings marches last weekend in the US.
Was it 7 million people who went to this?
Absolutely.
So this is quite important stuff.
Yeah. The numbers aren't small and they are vocal. So there is another side to what we all see when we feel as if there is no resistance.
Okay. Another very interesting interview with a man called Scott Galloway.
Yeah, the Scott Galloway piece is absolutely brilliant, actually. I didn't know an awful lot about him. He's a millionaire tech entrepreneur and professor of marketing based in London. He's written a book called Notes on Being a Man. Really interesting stuff about teaching young men to have resilience and also teaching them to ask women out and get turned down, because he thinks that's a really important part of growing up. He says he foresees terrible consequences if young men don't take risks in relationships. He also says that women can cope without relationships. We're absolutely fine. We channel it into family, cats, you know, whatever. But he says that young men will go to pieces without a relationship, and he's really worried about it because everyone's on their phones and not asking women out and getting turned down.
Okay, I agreed with some of his top tips. Not all of them. He does actually urge young men to get out of the house.
Get out of the house, he says. Yeah, aim to spend no time at home, 7 hours for sleeping and recharging your devices. Also, really quickly, there's a young up-and-comer on the cover of the magazine. Paul McCartney, look out for him.
He's a popular crooner.
He might do things.
Well, I don't know. Almost 3 o'clock.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon. It's 3 o'clock. This is Jane Garvey on Times Radio. Fee is off, but she's back on Monday on the programme in the next hour. The only soldier prosecuted over the Bloody Sunday massacre has been found not guilty of murder. Three men have been arrested in London on suspicion of assisting Russia's intelligence services. And, much less seriously, who might be the new hosts of Strictly Come Dancing? Here's the news at three from Stuart Willey.
Jane, thank you. Good afternoon. A former British paratrooper accused of murdering two people on Bloody Sunday has been found not guilty on all charges. The judge said the evidence fell short of the standard required. It was the first prosecution over the 1972 killings of 13 people taking part in a civil rights demonstration. Soldier F always denied shooting two unarmed protesters in Londonderry. David Young is from the Northern Ireland Veterans Movement.
Veterans across the whole of the United Kingdom that served in Northern Ireland with honour and courage will be heartened by this verdict today. And I hope that there is no more soldiers brought to the courts here.
Three men have been arrested on suspicion of assisting Russia's intelligence service. Counter-terrorism police in London say the men, all in their 40s, were arrested this morning. They warn of an increasing number of proxies being recruited by foreign spy agencies. The Prime Minister says he has faith in his safeguarding minister, Jeff Phillips, as some victims of grooming gangs call for her to resign. Four women who quit the inquiry into the gang say they'll return if the minister goes. The former Labour Home Office Minister, Tony McNulty, told Times Radio, Jess Phillips should now step down.
When the minister becomes the story and gets in the way of the implementation of the policy, especially in an area as serious as this, then the minister has to go. Ideally, she should step aside, because I think given her enormous experience in the area, for her, the outcome and the advance of the inquiry and the justice for the victims should be paramount.
Resident doctors in England are to go on strike for 5 days in mid-November. The British Medical Association says it's over pay restoration and employment prospects. But the Health Secretary, Wiz Streeting, says the move is reckless posturing that will harm patients. Steve McManus is the Chief Executive of Royal Berkshire Foundation Trust.
This primarily affects kind of our patients, delays some of their access to healthcare and treatment, and it affects the wider staff group as well. So, you know, my initial reaction is real disappointment.
A GP who supports Just Stop Oil and compared himself to Nelson Mandela has been suspended. 38-year-old Patrick Hart is serving a 12-month sentence for damaging a petrol station on the M25 with a hammer. At a tribunal, he was found to have a disregard for potential harm and for public safety. He was suspended for 10 months. Water companies in England have had their worst environmental performance on record, with serious pollution incidents up 60% last year. The Environment Agency says the results are poor and has called for a culture shift. And the King has prayed with the Pope in an historic moment at the Vatican's Sistine Chapel. It's the first time since Henry VIII split England from the Catholic Church in 1534 that such a service has taken place. Today's state visit forms part of Jubilee celebrations, which Catholics mark every 25 years. For a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Good afternoon. It's Jane Garvey on Times Radio until 4 o'clock. We'll talk about who might present Strictly and also the fact that the only soldier prosecuted for the events of Bloody Sunday has been found not guilty today. We'll talk about that in a couple of minutes' time. First, though, some breaking news from this afternoon. Resident doctors in England are set to go on strike for 5 days next month. This is according to the British Medical Association. The walkout is going to happen between the 14th and the 19th of November as part of ongoing industrial action over pay and job security. The health editor of The Times is Eleanor Haywood. Was this expected, Eleanor?
Sort of. There'd been some hopes last week that we might avert strikes because there's a new leadership of the BMA and they met with Wes Streeting for the first time last Monday, and sort of there were fairly positive noises coming out, but anyway, those weren't really justified, it turns out, because they've announced strikes today, a all-out 5-day full strike.
And did you say, sorry, the line's a little bit dodgy, did you say a full strike?
Yes, so complete walkout for 5 days in a row.
I see. And this will affect what, the entire country of England?
Yeah, about 30,000 doctors usually take part in these strikes, so all across England, across all NHS hospitals.
Now, this won't mean that there are no doctors working, because, quite frankly, more senior medics then move into position and do the work, don't they?
Yeah, so it tends to be A&E care gets prioritised, so some routine operations, routine clinics will probably get cancelled so that the doctors can prioritise cancer care, A&E, but that means you're still looking at thousands and thousands of cancellations of operations, appointments, and just huge disruption across the NHS.
Yeah, I mean, it's not good, obviously. What are the main gripes of the resident doctors?
There's two things. The first is pay. They say their pay has fallen by about 29% in real terms since 2008. Wes Streeting's come straight out of the blocks after this announcement and called it preposterous that they're striking, because junior doctors have had the biggest pay rise of any public sector workers over the past couple of years. They've had 29% pay rise. But compared to where they were in 2008, then their pay hasn't kept up with inflation. The second thing is there's a real issue of job security in that once junior doctors finish their first 2 years of training in the NHS, getting a further post, a specialty post, to train to become a consultant is really difficult because there's not really enough training posts.
I see. And in the past, there has been more than a degree of support for doctors, but I wonder whether the public's patience might be slightly stretched by this one. It's quite a long walkout, 5 days. And at a time of year when things like flu and the norovirus and everything else starts to have an impact.
Yeah, they've really lost public support. All the polls have been quite clear on that. I mean, when it was under the Conservative government and the strikes first began a couple of years ago, I think it was well over half of the public supported them. And that's dipped below half and I think is going down. I think especially when, they have had a big pay rise and are relatively well paid compared to the rest of the public sector, then people's sympathy has been stretched quite thin. I mean, I think the point Wes Streeting and people are making is that these strikes are a bit rushed, that, you know, the talks only began last week. Could they not have given it a bit more of a chance to try and reach a deal instead of going straight in with a 5-day strike?
Well, I guess they'd argue that threatening a strike and naming the date might shove things along a bit.
Yeah, exactly. And they're saying that, you know, they've been very clear all along that unless they can get this big pay rise, they'll keep striking. And West Streeting's been equally clear that a pay rise isn't on the table. So, you know, it kind of was always only ever going to end one way, I think.
Thank you, Eleanor. Eleanor Haywood, health editor at The Times. Just to emphasise those strike dates, the 14th to the 19th of November, resident doctors striking for 5 days. Now, the only soldier prosecuted over the Bloody Sunday massacre has been found not guilty of murder 53 years after the shootings. 13 people were killed when the parachute regiment opened fire on a civil rights demonstration in Londonderry in Northern Ireland. The former paratrooper was only ever referred to as Soldier F. This is David Johnson. He is the Veterans Commissioner for Northern Ireland, and he's speaking after today's ruling.
Society in Northern Ireland must find a way to deal with legacy issues in a fair and in a balanced way, one which will not disproportionately focus on the actions of the military or police and distort the historical record of the conflict. It must be remembered that 9 out of 10 deaths during the Troubles were caused by terrorist organisations. And many veterans are rightly concerned that too often legal processes are used to twist the truth, rewrite history, and shift focus away from the reality that terrorists on both sides were responsible for the conflict, and there was never any justification for terrorist actions.
David Johnson, the Veterans Commissioner for Northern Ireland. Mickey McKinney is the brother of William McKinney, who was killed on Bloody Sunday. He gave his reaction to today's verdict.
Soldier F had been discharged from a defendant's criminal dock, but it is 1 million miles away from being an honourable discharge. Mm. Unlike his victims, there has been no declaration of Soldier F's innocence. Soldier F created 2 young widows on Bloody Sunday. He orphaned 12 children and he deprived dozens of siblings of a loving brother. The Bloody Sunday families do not lay the blame for today's decision on the trial judge. The blame lies firmly with the British state, with the RUC, and with the British Army, who shielded and enabled its soldiers to continue to murder with impunity and immunity.
Well, that's Mickey McKinney, brother of William McKinney, killed on Bloody Sunday. Kiva Quinn is a correspondent in Belfast for U105. Kiva, can you just tell us exactly what Soldier F had been accused of?
Good morning. Yes, so Soldier F had appeared in court. He was facing charges of the murder of 2 men during that civil rights protest in Derry in 1972. And it was James Ray and William McKinney. And he also faced the charge of attempted murder for 5 others on that day. So, of course, we've heard that verdict this morning that he was found not guilty on those 7 charges. And we've just been following the reaction here.
Yes, of course. And it was always going to be a difficult day for many people, including, of course, the families of the men who were killed on Bloody Sunday. Can you just remind us why there was no jury here?
There was no jury in the trial, as it was the judge had to decide. Obviously, it was a very complicated trial. We saw Soldier F, for example, his identity was protected. They weren't releasing the name or any description of him to protect his identity moving forward. And because it was so complex, we had evidence from Soldiers G and Soldiers H, which the judge had to consider and take into consideration, which, of course, he said fell short when it came to looking at the evidence to see if Soldier F was guilty of those crimes he was accused of. It's a very complicated case, and Judge Patrick then presided over it.
Yes, and it was interesting that Mickey McKinney made it clear that he didn't blame the judge for the verdict, but felt that it was the British state that was responsible, which not unnaturally is what he would think. Why was nobody else prosecuted? Why just this one man? We should say he's in his 70s, isn't he?
That's correct, yes. So if you go back to the inquiry many years ago, we would have saw it was actually around 18 soldiers, I believe, who were accused of different crimes, but Soldier F was the only one that it actually came to court over. So it was very much, we were watching this because it could set the precedent, you know, going forward for what way these cases would be handled, because, you know, it's a history here in Northern Ireland, and as we've heard many times today, it's a history that does need a way to find to be addressed. And looking back on that, you can see that 2019, I believe, maybe 2020, the prosecution did decide to drop that case against Soldier F, and it wasn't until 2022 that legal action then saw that being brought back to the court. So that is why it has taken so long for it to be addressed, and it's just a matter now of looking at that reaction and seeing how we go forward, and of course what way we deal with these legacy cases going forward.
Yeah, I mean, it's not easy. David Johnson did point out that, I think he said, 9 out of 10 deaths during the Troubles were caused by terrorist organisations on both sides, and there are those who argue that prosecutions like this one, no doubt pretty expensive, there's a false equivalence here, because members of terrorist organisations are not pursued in the same way. How much truth is there in that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we've very much seen two sides following this court case when it comes out about the reactions and what has been told in and outside of the court. Now, terrorist organisation, the argument put forward here is that this was the British Army. We saw in the conclusion today that there was never an argument that the soldiers did not fire upon the unarmed civilians during that civil rights march in Derry. The judge said that very much happened and they should in fact hang their heads in shame for that action. The issue was that there wasn't enough evidence to say that it was Soldier F who had murdered or attempted to murder those seven people. So
yeah,
when we look at this case, you know, and the different ways people would argue that the British Army has to, of course, be held to a higher standard. The likes of the paramilitaries here, you know, they are not a government organisation. They're not representing. So there is that, you know, unfortunate free rein. But when it comes to the British Army, there does have to be accountability. And there is that higher expectation from people that, you know, they will be held to account if there are crimes committed.
Kiva, thank you for making that really complicated story so clear. We really appreciate your help this afternoon. That's Kiva Quinn, a correspondent in Belfast for U105. And of course, the then British Prime Minister David Cameron did apologise, didn't he, for the events of Bloody Sunday. Now, our guest this afternoon is Peter James, the great crime writer. And Peter will also feature as a part of the Off Air with Jane and Fee podcast today. You are guaranteed a good interview every single time we unleash an off-air, and we do so Monday to Thursday, just after 6 o'clock. We've had some really interesting guests recently, the likes of Rick Astley, Elizabeth Day, the great foreign correspondent Lise Doucette. And earlier this week, I talked on the programme and on the podcast to Amy Wallace, the co-writer of Virginia Giuffre's memoir, Nobody's Girl. She discussed the book and indeed Virginia Giuffre's life. And she told me that she thinks Prince Andrew should lead the charge by sharing everything he knows about Jeffrey Epstein with investigators.
If he does care about that, I think there is more room for him to be more active. And by which I mean, this is a man. Well, let's leave aside what he does or does not admit to. He was in those houses. He was on that island. He was on the jets. Those jets were remodeled to have a lot of bedrooms. That was the entire way. They were gutted inside and then bedrooms. They were places to traffic girls. So he saw things that were going on. And if he cares so deeply about this, he could share that information with investigators. This is what happened. Let me validate their experience.
Well, that's Amy Wallace. She's a really interesting woman, an award-winning American journalist who helped to write Virginia Giuffre's memoir, Nobody's Girl, which came out this week. You can download that episode of Off Air and loads of others wherever, of course, you get your podcasts from. Now, next, Tess and Claudia are only stepping away from Strictly. Who on earth can take their places? This is Jane Garvey on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
When you're growing a small business, you need someone who understands the ins and outs. And whether you're a tailor or an accountant, you need the tools to succeed. With an HSBC Small Business Banking account, you'll have free accounting tools and access to our business specialists, virtually or in person. Because whatever your small business looks like, we're with you all the way. Search HSBC Small Business Banking account to get started. Subject to application, eligibility, credit check and T's and C's. Visit hsbc.co.uk for details.
Here's to the moment. To the places that give you perspective and the people who change that perspective. The curiosity that leads you to the edge of the earth and the joy that meets you there. Silversea brings you closer to the rare, the remote and the remarkable. On spacious yet intimate ships that show you what most miss. Here's to having every reason to celebrate, to finding more. Learn more at silversea.com.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
Visit Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms, helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
20 past three, or thereabouts. Three men have been arrested in London today on suspicion of assisting Russia's intelligence services. Let's talk to Danny Shaw, Home Affairs correspondent, former advisor to Yvette Cooper. Danny, we can't say a lot because this is obviously now an active case, but what do we know for sure?
Well, this development was brought to us by the Metropolitan Police, and it happened today. Three men, aged 48, 45 and 44, were arrested at addresses in West and Central London. Searches are going on at those addresses and also another address in West London. And they have been arrested, these three men, on suspicion of assisting a foreign intelligence service. Now, that's contrary to Section 3 of the National Security Act 2023. They've been taken to a police station in London. And critically, the alleged offences relate to Russia. And The Times is reporting that the allegations concern attempts to track down dissidents and others of interest to the Kremlin. We've also had a statement from Commander Dominic Murphy. He's the head of counterterrorism policing in London. And he says we're seeing an increasing number of who we would describe as proxies being recruited by foreign intelligence services. These arrests are directly related to our ongoing efforts to disrupt this type of activity. So proxies, so people who have been recruited by foreign intelligence services to do their sort of dirty work for them, as it were. He says anyone who might be contacted by and tempted into carrying out criminal activity on behalf of a foreign state here in the UK should think again. This kind of activity will be investigated and anyone found to be involved can expect to be prosecuted. There are potentially very serious consequences for those who are convicted. Now, Jane, this comes after a statement, you might remember last week, a speech actually, that was given by Sir Ken McCallum, who's the head of the security service MI5. And he said this about Russia. He said that over the past year, the intelligence services and the police have disrupted a steady stream of surveillance plot with hostile intent aimed at individuals Russian leaders perceive as their enemies. So that's clearly not connected to the events today. That's separate. But this is a speech he gave last week. He said, we're also seeing Russia-based figures continuing to use online platforms in wider attempts, largely unsuccessful, to sow the seeds of violence, chaos and division here in the UK. So there you get a sense of the sort of overall threat picture posed by Russia. And then we've got today's arrests.
Yes, really interesting stuff. Is it any defence in a court if you can say, oh, well, yes, I did take 250 quid, let's say, to do X, but I had no idea who I was working for. I certainly didn't think it was a foreign power. Does that get you any credit or do you just emerge as a bit of an idiot?
Well, I mean, you can certainly put forward that defence. It would be up to the prosecution to prove that you were either negligent or you must have known who you were working for, or you did know and that you're lying. So, you know, I mean, it could potentially be a defence that, you know, you just had literally no idea and you thought it was for some sort of benign activity, but it would be for the prosecution to prove that. And certainly I think there have been cases where people have put forward such a defence, but there have also been successful prosecutions. You remember the Bulgarian nationals who were arrested and convicted, six people convicted in May, and they were doing work for Russia. They were convicted of espionage offences and so on, facing lengthy jail sentences. And there have been others as well. Five men convicted in July of setting fire to an East London warehouse. That was containing supplies for Ukraine. That was also inspired by Russia. So you can see the threat that the country poses.
Thank you very much. That's Danny Shaw, who's a Home Affairs correspondent. The big story of the day, well, there is only one really, and it concerns this. Well, whatever you think about the show, and there are mixed opinions, I think it's fair to say, I mean, that tune is an absolute banger. Anyway, they're off. Tess and Claudia have had enough. They're announced they're going to be leaving the show at the end of this series. No official reason for their departure, but it does come after the BBC show made headlines for scandals involving bullying behind the scenes. Alex Farber is the Times media correspondent. OK, Alex, this is a shocker. How did you hear the news? Was it via a press release?
Oh, well, I heard it. It was not via a press release. It was via a statement from the pair on Instagram, who said that they were going to be stepping back at the end of this series on Christmas Day after, you know, for Tess Daly's case, 20 years with the show and almost a decade, more than a decade, Claudia Winkleman. So, yeah, it did come out of the blue a little bit, but speaking to people today, I'm not sure there's a huge amount of surprise given the length of time that both have been with the programme.
Yeah, you say it's not a surprise. I must admit, I was a bit surprised. Not least, actually, genuinely, because they're both rather good at it. And it's by no means easy to do a show like this live. And they manage it, and they're both very good. They both look amazing. Claudia is incredibly funny. And they deserve credit, don't they, for their ability. They're good.
Absolutely. You know, they are have been consummate hosts, and you referred to some of the issues that the show has had in the past few years with regards to bullying and bad behaviour. But one thing that where the programme hasn't suffered is on screen. You know, the show's audiences have remained consistently high. I think Chris McCausland won last year's series in front of about 10 million people. Yeah. So the show has maintained its affection with audiences. But one thing that Tess and Claudia have done extraordinarily well is keep the show on the road. You know, they've been there every Saturday night for a major part of the year, you know, with all the sequins and the spangles, and really given everyone that warm bath television. And, you know, they have been there and they are the front people for it, but that's not to detract. You know, the show will go on. The strength of Strictly Come Dancing is in the format itself and the joy that people get from the celebrities and their partners more than the hosts themselves, who I shouldn't take it away, their ability to make it a very welcoming environment. But, you know, the format is really bulletproof, and that's what the BBC will be banking on as they look to the future.
Yes, I mean, I should also just say that during COVID, they kept it going too. And I think that meant a tremendous amount, actually, to a lot of people. But you're right, of course, it's the people involved in the makeup and the costumes and the band there, the live band who are there every week. A lot of people have a great deal of affection for this programme. Can it keep going? I wonder whether at some point or another those scandals might just prove too much. What do you think?
Well, look, I think it's a show where the faintest whiff of scandal attracts a lot of attention because of the very mainstream family type of programme it is.
Yeah.
But as I said, one thing that hasn't really gone downhill in the time that it's been on air has been the audience numbers. And, you know, the BBC doesn't take that for granted, and Sarah James and the creative team there work hard every year to keep innovating, trying to make it a bigger and better programme so that on screen when, you know, lots of those fans, those loyal army of fans tune in week after week, you know, the programme is as best as it possibly can be. And they don't sit on their laurels. This is the end of an era for Strictly Come Dancing. There's no doubt about that. But I'm not sure the BBC will be super nervous about the wheels falling off because, as I said, the strength of the format is bigger than the host at the front of the show.
Well, let's cut to the chase. Who's going to take over?
Well, there's been a lot of speculation about that. As you can imagine, look, it's early days. And I think, you know, the announcement was brought forwards a bit, my understanding is, from Claudia and Tess, because I think word was starting to leak out. So the BBC will be succession planning already. Names that I've heard mentioned have included Ryland Clark, the Radio 2 host, Clara Amfo, her name's been mentioned, and also that It Takes Two duo, who is Fleur East and Jeanette. They've also been mentioned as potential candidates, given their close proximity to the show, and the fact that the BBC might want to introduce a little bit of diversity when it comes to new hosts. More left-field ideas, perhaps Alan Carr and Amanda Holden. You know, Alan's stock is very high at the moment off Celebrity Faces.
He's
worked very well with Amanda on their holiday, their travel format.
I agree. I don't think Alan's left-field. I'd go straight to him and offer him as much money as he wants. And he is funny with Amanda. They'd work very well together. What about Amal Raja? He normally gets all the jobs. Is no one talking about him?
No, for a change, this isn't a job that Amal Rajan's name's been connected with. But as you say, Jane, as you just referenced then, you know.
No, I'm Jane, but don't worry. Fee's not here.
I can't see you.
No, that's true.
I can't see you, so I'm in a crackly hotel. Part of the magic of the show is the chemistry between the presenters, and that's what they will be looking to get right as much as anything. So the fact that they can point to success of Alan and Amanda will go a lot, or Flea and Jeanette goes some way. The names that have been mentioned, you know, Emma and Matt Willis, could they do it? Or even Jane and Fee. You know, is there an outside chance of you guys giving over your Saturday night?
I said it earlier that we turned it down, actually, Alex. I mean, I've obviously known.
Oh, you've already. I can rule you out.
Yeah, you can, absolutely. Don't include us. Thank you very much, Alex. That's Alex Farber with all the excitement surrounding the big announcement of the day that they're leaving Strictly, Tess and Claudia. Strictly Come Dancing. Never watched it, never will. A load of mindless rubbish, says Lynn. But how do you know, Lynn? If you've honestly never given it even 10 minutes of your time. I'm here to tell you, I don't watch it every week, but honestly, and particularly during COVID, I found it an absolutely wonderful telly comfort blanket. And I think I probably speak for lots of people when I say that. Victoria's another refuse, Nick. The only decent thing about it is the theme tune. Wonderful. Thank you, Ryan. Our big interview is with Peter James on his latest novel, The Hawk is Dead. That is next on Times Radio. Let's get the headlines with Stuart Willey at 3:30.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Jane, thank you. Good afternoon. Resident doctors in England are going on strike for 5 days next month in their row over pay and jobs. The British Medical Association says members who are early on in their careers are struggling to find work, despite millions of patients waiting for treatment. A former British paratrooper accused of murdering two people and attempting to murder five others on Bloody Sunday has been found not guilty on all counts. Soldier F was cleared of killing James Ray and William McKinley in Londonderry in 1972. The Prime Minister says he has faith in his safeguarding minister, Jess Phillips, as some victims of grooming gangs call for her to resign. Aubrey Allegretti is the Times' chief political correspondent.
You do have four survivors who have publicly stepped down from their roles on the Home Office panel. It sounds like there might be a fifth that's decided to do so as well. So the government wants to appear to be listening and conciliatory, but ultimately it's standing full square behind Jess Phillips and it's deciding not to take the approach of those that have called for her to stand down.
The government's spending watchdog has announced it wants more information about the lease arrangements on Prince Andrew's home. He's paid negligible amounts of rent on Royal Lodge at Windsor for the past two decades. And there's been a 13% rise in shoplifting in England and Wales in the year to June. Official police figures also reveal a 5% drop in knife crime. For a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
Stop. Listen. Chicken.
The 10 mini fillet bucket, £7.99. 10 succulent mini fillets. Buy, eat, digest. Good, repeat. Get the deal, believe in chicken. KFC. Until 9th of November, subject to availability, participating restaurants only, excludes delivery. Full T's and C's at kfc.co.uk.
My dad was a fantastic builder. Plumbing, electrics, carpentry, there was nothing he couldn't do. But he's 83 now, and he can't do any of that stuff anymore. That's hard when you've always been so capable. Unfortunately, Mum died a couple of years ago now, so he does feel quite isolated. Huh. At least he did until Kerry arrived. She's been amazing. She's Dad's care professional from Home Instead. They provide the best quality care in your own home. Dad'll never want to leave that cottage. Well, he restored it practically from scratch, all on his own. We all pop over to see him whenever we can, but we've all got busy lives. So it's real peace of mind that Kerry can be there when we're not. She helps him with all the things he can't do for himself anymore. But we've told her the only things he's allowed to do relating to building is make Dad's favourite builder's brew.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
Looking to grow your investments and generate a long-term income? The Scottish American Investment Company, also known as SAINTS, could help. SAINTS has been investing for over 150 years and focuses on growing capital as well as income by investing in a diverse range of companies from around the world. SAINTS is managed by Baillie Gifford, manager for some of the UK's best-known investment trusts. Find out key information and more at baillieGifford.com. As with any investment, capital is at risk and income is not guaranteed.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. 8 new kitchen styles now available, with prices starting from under £3,000. Whether you choose dusky pink, hazy blue or one of the other new styles, you'll be delighted with your kitchen transformation. Find out more at wix.co.uk.
Our big guest of the day is the crime writer Peter James. Fee has been talking to him.
Peter James is one of our finest crime writers. He is created in Detective Grace, played beautifully by John Sims in the Grace series on ITV, a really highly watchable, empathetic character. He loves his detailed research, and in his latest book, which is called The Hawk is Dead, that detailed research means that he got access to Buckingham Palace and St James's Palace to write his latest novel, which centres around an assassination attempt on Queen Camilla. I started by asking Peter how he was allowed to write that.
Sure. It all began back in 2015. I got a phone call from a mate of mine. He said, "Whatever you're doing, stop doing it. Go about. Got and buy a copy of the Daily Mail and turned to page 3. And there on page 3 was a photograph of the Duchess of Cornwall in her office with a bookshelf behind her and two of my Roy Grace novels right behind her head. And she said, I was in the article, I was one of her two favourite authors. I think the other was Jane Austen. And I was just blown away. And I wrote to her and I just said, thank you so much. And she wrote a really chatty letter back saying, I genuinely love your books. I've read every single Roy Grace novel and some of your standalones. And for the next 2 years, I would send her the latest Roy Grace. And she'd always write a chatty letter. She wrote one thing, oh, I've kept me company on the way to Australia. I'm now bereft. I don't know what I'm going to read on the way back. And then she wrote to me and she said, when are you going to set Roy Grace in London? And I thought, well, you know, people who've disobeyed past queens of England, things have not ended well for them. So I'd better think carefully about this. And she started, as I'm sure you know, the Queen, this amazing book club during lockdown, trying to encourage people around, not just in the UK, but around the world to read, you know, helping them through the kind of isolation of lockdown. And also doing research into the benefits of reading. Yeah, she discovered that just people who read just 5 minutes a day have this massive impact on their well-being, both mental and physical. And she had her first literary festival at Hampton Court, and I went along. I was invited to speak, and there was a senior member of the royal household came along. The Queen really is quite serious about setting the book in London. I think she'd quite like it if you set it in Buckingham Palace.
We shouldn't give away too much of the plot, but I think that we should definitely talk, Peter, about how the book opens, because actually
the powers of imagination are stretched, aren't they, to actually quite a dark place where Camilla seems to be the target of an assassination attempt. And I don't know what it would have felt like to write that. Can you tell us?
Yeah, I had, obviously, I had to be kind of really sensitive. I didn't want to come across as sycophantic. I wanted to portray both Camilla, who I met many times, and the king as kind of real, pretty much as themselves. And I thought, okay, how do I get Roy Grace to Buckingham Palace? And I've always been fascinated by the royal train. I know it's going to be decommissioned soon, but it's been used for many decades by the royal household as a kind of, they jokingly call it a palace on wheels. This is actually a hotel on wheels. And if they're staying overnight somewhere, rather than have to go back to London, it's parked in a siding. And I thought, what about if Queen Camilla is coming to Brighton for the start of a two-day tour of hospices along the south of England? Roy Grace in Brighton has been tipped off that there's going to be a big Not My King protest greeting her at Brighton Station. But then as the train enters the tunnel just north of Brighton, famous tunnel called Clayton Tunnel, the train is derailed. And as they emerge from the tunnel, a senior member of the royal household standing next to her is shot dead by a sniper. And everyone immediately thinks this is a failed assassination attempt on the Queen. And Roy Grace immediately comes to the scene because it's on his patch. And he disagrees. He says, I think the sniper might miss by 4 inches, but not by 4 feet. He then comes into conflict with the Met Police, and the King, King Charles says, who is this hillbilly cop in Sussex? You know, I want the Met on this.
And Peter, what's so extraordinary for the reader is that you're right, the depictions of Queen Camilla and particularly of King Charles are not sycophantic. And actually, there were times when I thought, gosh, you've captured an element of, God, what would you describe it as with King Charles? The moments when he can appear a little bit brusque. Would that be a fair way of putting it?
Yeah, a little bit tetchy. yeah, yes. I've got this scene when he comes in and he really berates Roy Grace. And he stands up, puts both hands in his pockets. And I had different members of the household reading the book as I went along. And one man read this chapter and he said, no, the king would only ever put one hand in his pocket.
Right. Okay. Well, the book doesn't fall down on that detail not being entirely accurate. And actually, let's talk a bit about the art, because those royal collections, or should I just say the royal collection, is just extraordinary. And it does make you realise, Peter, just how much value there is contained within those palaces, and actually stuff that we never see. Is it possible to put a price on all of the things that the royal family has in its possession?
I don't think so. I think it's billions and billions. I mean, it is amazing. When I was given terrific sort of behind the scenes access, I started off because when I came up with the idea for the story, I sent it in to a senior member of the household who, then gave it to the Queen, and I thought she'd be saying, no, nonsense, you can't have this. And she apparently loved it, laughed her head off, and then Buckingham Palace Commons, to my amazement, signed it off. But I had this, first of all, this 3.5 hour, and the palace is enormous. And I was down in the basement, and then along all the corridors, and I said to this member of the household who was taking me around, I said, how do you ever learn to navigate here? He said, I asked Prince Philip that question about 16 years ago. He said, it's very easy, dear boy, you navigate by the paintings.
Oh, but what happens if a painting then is put in a different place or goes missing? You'd be lost forever.
Then you get lost. And I've got a scene in the book when Queen Camilla actually does show Roy Grace around some of the paintings, which is kind of, I really enjoyed writing that.
So you've had unique access, really, Peter, haven't you?
Had really amazing access, and what's brilliant is that I spent hours in the palace. I made all the central characters in the royal household fictitious. I've given them their real titles, like the Master of the Royal Household, the Keeper of the Privy Purse, but I give them fictitious names. But I thought, I cannot give King Charles and Queen Camilla fictitious names. I can't call them King Eric and Queen Doris. It wouldn't make the book feel real. So I put them as real characters, put real words in their mouth. And it got to the end of February and we were working on the edit. And I thought, I have got to let Queen Camilla read this, because if there's anything she doesn't like, now is the time we can change it. So my publishers bound up an early proof, and they printed 001 on the cover, gold embossed, and I had it hand delivered to the Queen, and I, with a note, and I just said, if there's anything you don't like, please let me know, and now is the time we can change it. And I got invited to Clarence House a week later, and I didn't sleep the night before. I thought, she's going to come up to me and she's going to say, terrible, you can't publish this, and that's a year of my life gone. And she came up with a big smile. She said, I absolutely love it. I couldn't believe it. I said, is there anything you want changed at all, Your Majesty? And she said, not one word. And I've since heard that she's actually calling senior members of the royal household by the names I've called them in the book.
Right, okay. Well, look, that is an accolade, isn't it? Do you think, because you have seen, you know, so much of the paintings and, you know, you talk about other artefacts that are contained within the palace, when you have seen all of these things, is there a part of you that thinks actually this is excess? If members of the public can never see all of this stuff, and a lot of it has been gifted, hasn't it, to the royal family over the years, then kind of what's the point in them having it? I mean, it must be a truth that if they sold, you know, just a quarter of the collection, then the coffers of the nation would benefit substantially.
Yeah, I think, but by selling it, it's a bit like that old thing of selling off the family silver. The Royal Collection Trust hold these, so it's not actually the royal family that own them. They are held by the Royal Collection Trust. And Buckingham Palace is being opened up more and more to the public. But I think it's part of the national treasure. It's like the extension of the crown jewels. It is part of the wealth of the nation. I guess in a worst case scenario, they could start selling some of it off. But I think it's important heritage. And there are some astonishing pieces. I think my favorite room that I've seen in the palace is one that I don't think has ever been open to the public, but maybe it's called the Indian Room. And it is full of swords and daggers from the 1850s. And I learned that in the 1800s, Indians were the Rolls Royce of sword makers. If you were in a sword fight, you'd want to have a sword made of Indian steel. And there's a wonderful dagger in there, which in fact, which I use in the climax of the book, called the Ibrahim dagger. And it's beautifully ornate, but the middle of the blade has got a cut in it, a slit, filled with pearls. And if you pick it up, it goes clack, 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 clack. And it's not decorative. It was actually used if you stabbed your opponent. The pearls would help to bring out part of your opponent's innards.
Okay, well, that's a lovely thing. If you're listening to this on the podcast late at night, there's the imagery to see you through until dawn.
Yeah, absolutely.
Roy Grace, we usually find in Brighton, don't we? And actually, I think what you do manage to create so beautifully in the books there is that dark underbelly of a town that so many people will know for its kind of ability to give us pleasure and fun. I know that you don't live in Brighton anymore. So does it become harder to write about that if, I think you live in Jersey now, don't you, with the golden sand stretching out in front of you?
Yeah, we live in Jersey, but also we have a flat on the seafront in Worthing, which is only just 10 miles down the coast from Brighton. And I'm back and forth a lot. I still go out with the police regularly in Brighton. Obviously, we're filming Grace. It's just finished filming its sixth season. So I'm back there for some of the filming some of the time. And I love Brighton. I mean, I was very lucky in a sense when I first created Roy Grace in the first book back in came out in 2005, that very few writers had written about Brighton. And yet it is, it's both a beautiful city and it has a very dark underbelly. And one of the interesting things also, and it's a great connection with this book, is that Queen Camilla actually, she grew up in Sussex, only about 15 miles from Brighton. Their sort of main home was a place called Plumpton. So she's got Sussex roots also. So it was a nice synergy to actually have a connection between Roy Grace and Queen Camilla of Sussex and the palace.
But do you think that Camilla's family were part of that dark underbelly, Peter?
No, definitely not. I heard a recent lovely story about her father, about what an extraordinarily honourable man he was. So no, I don't think remotely. And I think, but she's got a wicked sense of humour.
Has she?
Oh yes. She, I remember she came down to the filming of Grace, and spent an hour watching some of the filming, meeting the cast, John Cena, everyone. And I said to her, I said, jokingly, I said, maybe you'd like to be an extra. She said, perhaps I could be a dead body.
Gosh, well, that would be something, wouldn't it?
That would be something. Venom, I saw her several times during where I was writing the book. I've got this one scene when she gives, asked her how breakfast worked with her and the king, because that's in a second chapter in the book, and she feeds the dogs some toast. But then I saw her in July, and she said to me, how's the book coming along? I said, well, Your Majesty, I've got you being quite heroic. You helped get everybody off the train when it's derailed in the tunnel. And she looked at me with a quizzical smile. She said, I don't know if I would be that heroic, you know.
Well, maybe that's in episode 2. Before we leave you, Peter, can we talk just a little bit about the art of writing? Because actually, we discussed this quite a lot on our programme and on our podcast, how writers write, and also the ghostwriting thing, the celebrity authors who don't write their own books, all of that kind of stuff. And I wonder how you feel about that when you see, especially at this time of year, that there is a chance that in the bestseller lists will be people who are astonishingly good at something else in the world of entertainment, who are now basically saying that they've written a novel, but we kind of all know that they haven't. Does that upset you at all?
No, I don't. I mean, it's happened for years, I think, with Shirley Conran and Lace too, and books like that were not actually written by her. I think, to me, as a writer, the most important thing that people buy books, read books, love books. I think the writers who tend to have a sort of celebrities who have a ghost-written book, they don't tend to last that long. If you like, the writers that endure generally are the really good writers who. And I think the most important thing in writing is character. You know, we read books to find out what happens to characters we engage with. They don't have to be nice people. You know, Hannibal Lecter's not the most nice guy in the world. And, you know, Dracula's not the nicest person. But these characters have something about them that makes us want to read on. And, you know, we do. We meet characters at the beginning of a book. And that's what really drives us forward. I think secondly is research. Because people who read, everyone who reads is intelligent. And I think when we read a book, we don't just want a page-turning story. We want to learn something, whether it's about the author's wisdom of life or a subject the author's writing about. I think readers can tell very quickly if an author is making this up or actually has done their research and knows the subject.
I like the fact that you really detail the team that's around you in the acknowledgements at the back of your books. And actually, it's quite an insight into the life of the writer. And you say, you know, you might imagine that this is a kind of isolated experience, but you owe an awful lot to an awful lot of other people. And it is good to say that, isn't it? It's good to shine a bit of light on what the craft actually means.
Yes, I do. I think people have the image of the lone writer in their garret, and there are plenty of writers who do write that, like that. But I'm much more collegiate in a sense. I go out with the police a lot. On this book, On the Hawk is Dead, I have had phenomenal help, you know, from various different members of the household and people around the household. And obviously my beloved wife, and I have a real life Roy Grace. David Gaylor, who I first met when he was a detective inspector at Brighton Police back in 1997. And we just clicked. And he helped me on research on a couple of my pre-Roy Grace thrillers. And then he got promoted to Detective Chief Superintendent, Head of Major Crime for Sussex in 2002, where my publishers asked if I'd ever thought of creating a detective as a central character. And I said, how would you like to be a fictional cop? And he loved it. And we've worked together closely on every Roy Grace book. And he tells me how Roy would actually think and act as a real copper. Mm-hmm. And he's helped bring that sort of reality to the books, I think.
Do you think that you could now be an exceptional criminal who would never get caught?
I know exactly how to get away with murder, with all kinds of crimes. What would separate me out from that is conscience. You know, the,
Oh, but they all say that, Peter. We don't know that. We don't know that.
I know that. I know. I think, could I get away with it? We're all capable of committing all kinds of crimes. And I think, yeah, I definitely would know good ways to get rid of a body. The difference between, if you like, the sociopath stroke psychopath and most of the rest of us is that most of the rest of us, if we commit a crime, at some point we'll have to tell someone, you know, I'd have to take, you know, my mate out for a drink. So listen, I murdered Wendy, but it's all right because I love Doris, isn't it? And mate would say, actually, it's not all right. Now you've told me I'm an accessory. And that's how so many killers get caught. They can't live with it forever.
And can I just ask you this question? Because you do know more about the royal family, have been close to them than many of us will ever be. They've got a massive problem at the moment, Peter, haven't they, with one of their own? And I wonder what your thoughts have been as you have seen the world around the man that we still have to call Prince Andrew become darker and darker and darker.
Yeah, I met him once and I thought he was among the most odious people I've ever met. I think it's been tough. I mean, I know that the late Queen Elizabeth was very fond of him. But I think it is a massive embarrassment. You know, I do think, you know, King Charles and Queen Camilla, they had their own battle. You know, I think after the death of Princess Di, and then when he really got together with Camilla, she was vilified. And she's come through that, and you know, she's really done an extraordinary job, both with the royal, the Queen's reading room, and with the other charities, domestic abuse in particular. And people have gained real respect for her. And I think people have gained respect for King Charles. And I think Andrew is just pulling the royal family into a really bad direction. And I think the sooner that he's cut adrift, then people can focus on actually the really good work that the Princess Anne does, the King does, and the Queen does.
How far adrift would you like to see him cut?
I think he should be stripped of his prince title and maybe sent to a far-flung corner of the world. I think all the time he's around, he does seem to be a massive embarrassment to everybody, and he doesn't seem to have any sense of shame.
Interesting. That was Peter James, the crime writer, clearly somebody who's pretty close to Queen Camilla. And Peter was not mincing his words about Andrew, was he? That was Peter James talking to Fee. His new book is The Hawk is Dead, and it's out now.
The Sunday Times Get Britain Reading campaign.
It's Jane Garvey on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
In the ever-changing world of current affairs, nothing stands still. Times Radio Breakfast is your essential weekend briefing with incisive analysis on all the latest developments in politics, culture and entertainment. Plus all the latest financial news with the Weekend Money Check. Times Radio Breakfast, Saturday and Sunday mornings from 6 on Times Radio with Handelsbanken. Banking done differently since 1871. Find out why at handelsbanken.co.uk.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Stop. Listen. Chicken. The 10 mini fillet bucket. £7.99. 10 succulent mini fillets. Buy. Eat. Digest. Good. Repeat. Get the deal. Believe in chicken. KFC. Until 9th of November. Subject to availability. Participating restaurants only. Excludes delivery. Full T's and C's at kfc.co.uk.
Tesco Finest. Alderwood Smoked Bacon. The foundation for the ultimate bacon butty. It's why only the finest bacon is traditionally hand-cured with Cornish sea salt, delicately smoked over alderwood, and matured for at least 19 days. Layer it between slices of crusty bread and savour its richer flavour. All you have to think about is brown sauce or red. Make your everyday taste better with Tesco Finest. Majority of larger stores.
Nobody asks to have a lifetime of memories slowly erased. Nobody asks to have a loved one not recognize them. Nobody asks to feel lonely and confused. But today, you could change this. By leaving a gift in your will to Alzheimer's Society, you'll help fund life-changing support, vital campaigning, and groundbreaking research to tackle Britain's biggest killer. Discover the impact your gift can make Search Alzheimer's Society Wills.
They're bubbly, they're fuzzy, and they're ruddy delicious.
At Oddbox, we rescue farm fresh fruit and veg that's too odd for supermarkets. Then we deliver direct to your door, so every box and every crunch makes a difference to growers and the planet. Use the code RADIO to get 50% off your first box at oddbox.co.uk and help fight food waste, one curvy cucumber at a time. Offer excludes delivery fees. Conditions apply.
At Buy Association, we stay one step ahead of the property market, and our team of experts have identified the halo at Oval Village as London's next landmark home. This stunning development with a coveted Zone 1 postcode offers luxury living overlooking the iconic Oval Cricket Ground. To find out more about 1, 2 and 3 bedroom apartments at the Halo Oval Village, request your free brochure today. Text BA Radio Oval to 66777 by association. Ahead of the market since 2005.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
If you're a fan of Peter James, the great crime writer, and you missed any of that interview, you can hear it as part of the Off Air with Jane and Fee podcast tonight. It should come your way around about 6 o'clock on all good podcast platforms. The Story is another excellent podcast, and today's edition is fascinating. Donald Trump is promising to give Argentina $20 billion to save its economy, but only if incumbent President Javier Milei holds on to power in the midterm elections. Why does Trump care who wins? Would a Milei victory be part of a South American swing to the right? And to Trump, and what happens if Argentina can't pay him back? Well, today's episode of The Story has been looking into exactly this. Manveen Rana spoke to Stephen Gibbs, Latin America contributor to The Times and The Sunday Times, and asked why Trump is giving so much money to a country 5,000 miles away.
The United States feels that in this region, in the Americas, it wants to make sure as many countries as possible are on the US side. And they're a bit worried about what's happening in Argentina, where they have an absolutely key ally, President Milei, but he's in trouble. He's running out of money to prop up the local currency, the peso, and the country with no shortage of dollars to help out is the United States.
Stephen Gibbs. Much more from him. He is the Latin America contributor for The Times and The Sunday Times on That Story podcast. He's in conversation with the excellent Manveen Rana, and you can hear the full episode on The Story. One story told in depth every single day, and it's available for free on all good and probably some adequate podcast platforms. That's all you need to know. John Pienaar is heading your way next on Times Radio. We're back on Monday at 2 o'clock. Don't forget, of course, Off Air with Jane and Fee. There's no escaping a plug for that podcast. It is available in exactly the same place as you get The Story from. If you get The Story, you can get Off Air with Jane and Fee as well. My producer today was Hugo Chambray, and our technical operator was the indefatigable Ryan Boyden. John Pienaar is next. I hope you have an excellent couple of days, and hope you can join us at 2 on Monday for both of us. Fee will no doubt be restored to full health by Monday, as long as she's sensible over the weekend and doesn't eat anything spicy. That's my fervent hope. John is next.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar with Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. Resident doctors will strike for 5 days in November in a dispute over pay and jobs. And a judge has found a British soldier not guilty of murder during Bloody Sunday, as the evidence against him fell well short. And coming up, I'll be talking to the chair of the British Medical Association's Resident Doctors Committee as the Health Secretary calls the planned action reckless posturing. And would you pay £180,000 a year for a tutor to prep your one-year-old for school? We'll hear why one family is planning to do exactly that.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Stuart Willey.
John, thank you. Good afternoon. Resident doctors in England are to go on strike for 5 days in mid-November. The British Medical Association says it's over pay restoration and employment prospects. But the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, says the move is reckless posturing that will harm patients. A former paratrooper accused of murdering two people on Bloody Sunday has been found not guilty. Soldier F, who can't be identified for legal reasons, was cleared of the killings at a 1972 civil rights march in Londonderry. The veteran, now in his 70s, was also acquitted of 5 attempted murders. Kiva Quinn is a journalist in Belfast for U105 Radio.
There was never an argument that the soldiers did not fire upon the unarmed civilians during that civil rights march in Derry. The judge said that very much happened and they should in fact hang their heads in shame. The issue was that there wasn't enough evidence to say that it was Soldier F who had murdered or attempted to murder those 7 people.
The Prime Minister is backing his safeguarding minister as a 5th survivor of sexual abuse calls on Jess Phillips to quit. She follows 4 others who think the minister accused them of lying when she said the inquiry would not be broadened. They say they'll return if the minister goes. Former Labour Home Office Minister Tony McNulty told Times Radio Jess Phillips should go now.
When the minister becomes the story and gets in the way of the implementation of the policy, especially in an area as serious as this, then the minister has to go. Ideally, she should step aside, because I think given her enormous experience in the area, for her, the outcome and the advance of the inquiry and the justice for the victims should be paramount.
Russia's former president, Dmitry Medvedev, says Donald Trump's oil sanctions are an act of war. The US president has put new sanctions on the 2 biggest Russian oil companies after the Kremlin rejected his proposal to freeze the war in Ukraine along the current front line. Bill Browder, the prominent Kremlin critic, told Times Radio they'll need to go further to stop the war.
These actions are significant. To go after the 2 biggest oil companies in Russia, Lukoil and Rosneft, and to basically say that they cannot do any type of business with the United States, and I think the same thing is true with the European Union, that is a punishing sanction. The sanctions mean that Lukoil can't sell oil to America, they can't bank with American banks, but it doesn't have anything to do with China or India.
3 men have been arrested on suspicion of assisting Russia's intelligence service. Counter-terrorism police in London say the men, all in their 40s, were arrested this morning. They warn of an increasing number of proxies being recruited by foreign spy agencies. Parliament's spending watchdog says it'll look into the lease arrangements for Prince Andrew's mansion in Windsor. The chair of the Public Accounts Committee is to write to the Crown Estate and the Treasury. This week, it emerged in the Times that the King's brother pays minimal rent after spending £8.5 million on leasing and refurbishments. And for a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, online and on your smart speaker. Quality journalism, analysis and opinion that speaks for itself. John Pienaar at Drive, on Times Radio.
Oh, I'm John Pienaar with Times Radio Drive. It's good to have your company. More coming up in just a moment. The news breaking just before we came on air. The resident doctors are to strike for 5 days in November. And meanwhile, say it softly, say it loudly. President Trump has hit Russia with what he's described as tremendous, so surely that means pretty serious at the very least, sanctions against Russian oil trading. Now, after all the threats and all the backtracking, Donald Trump may be hitting Vladimir Putin's regime with measures that'll hurt the Russian economy in a way that will set back Putin's funding of the war in Ukraine. Today, now, at the same time in Brussels, EU leaders are working, expected to approve a plan to turn seized Russian assets into a huge check for Ukraine to buy weapons and, by the way, help fill the gap left by President Trump, slowing down Americans' military aid to Ukraine to a virtual standstill. The war goes on. Ukraine is still hard up against it. Russia bombed a nursery yesterday, remember? But from Ukraine's point of view, this looks like a win-win. On today's show, we'll be looking at the action that's been taken by the White House and now in Brussels. How hard will these measures actually bite? But first, that news breaking just before we came on air. Resident doctors, that's around half of all doctors, are to strike for 5 days in the second week of November, from 7 a.m. on November the 14th to 7 a.m. on November the 19th, which is bad news for the NHS and bad news for everyone. Let's talk about that now and welcome, first of all, Eleanor Haywood,
The Times health correspondent is going to be with us very shortly with a bit of background on this developing story. I can talk now, though, to the chair of the British Medical Association's Resident Doctors Committee. That's Dr. Jack Fletcher. Hello to you.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for joining us, Dr. Fletcher. Can you just tell us, first of all, straight away, what is the payoff that would have averted this strike?
So this strike is a last resort. It was a very, very difficult decision. We have had some talks with the government. This strike is as a result of unemployed doctors. This is unemployed doctors. We don't have enough doctors in the UK. We're an under-doctored country, and we do not have enough jobs for doctors to get them working in the NHS, to get them treating patients in A&E, to get the waiting lists down. And on top of that, we are still losing doctors from the NHS at the same time because we aren't being fairly valued. What we're asking for is not a huge, significant pay rise in one go. We're willing to negotiate. We've been talking to the government over the last week. We're looking at numbers like just £1 an hour over a few years. We're willing to negotiate on that. The disappointing thing is that despite all of these unemployed doctors, the health secretary has not moved and is not coming up with a credible plan to fix this problem, to be able to get patients seen, to get waiting lists down, and to make sure that patients aren't being treading corridors anymore.
I will come back to the question of doctors' jobs in a minute, but it does seem, doesn't it, that the strike is being called primarily over pay. And in percentage terms, what sort of offer would have stopped this happening?
So it's not just a strike about pay. Pay is very much
part of it. And I will come to jobs, Dr. Fletcher, yeah. But what sort of pay offer were you demanding? Because we're heading for a strike, which is going to hurt a lot of people.